Welcome to the Droma Preventative Health Podcast, hosted by the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association. We provide you with up-to-date information on health topics geared towards the Orthodox Jewish community. This podcast content is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended as medical advice or as a substitute for the medical advice of a physician.
This is a kind of explanation and trigger warning. In terms of the focus of this interview, Dr. Nessel, as she says in the beginning, an academician, she is a food scientist. She focuses on food politics and public health issues related to this. She's not a clinician. I have done many related topics on eating disorder prevention, obesity, et cetera. So scroll back to see the different ones, about a dozen of them, and I'm going to highlight a few of them in the show notes to this episode. Also, as a trigger warning for everybody, I think food and eating is emotionally fraught pretty much for everybody, but for people who have eating disorders or struggle with their weight, it may be especially challenging, so listener discretion is advised. Welcome to the Jewish Orthodox Women's Medical Association, or JOMA, podcast. I'm your host, Elisa Minkin. I'm a general pediatrician. And today I'm really, really honored and really, really excited to be interviewing Dr. Marion Nessel. Again, if you have topics you want to hear, comments on the episodes I've done, you want to be interviewed, you know someone who you think should be interviewed, please reach out to us at health, H-E-A-L-T-H, at joma.org. We want to hear from you. I'm getting more requests and comments, and I really try to respond to each one of them, and I'm really excited about them because it really helps me be more responsive, and I get great ideas. One of which was, by the way, to do a index and number the podcast. And I do have to apologize. Everybody else's podcasts are numbered except ours. We're going to be trying to do that. We may even do that index, try to make it easier for people to find other episodes. So, Marion Nessel, who can be reached at Marion, Marion.Nestle at NYU.edu. is Paulette Goddard Professor of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health Emerita at New York University in the department she chaired from 1988 to 2003, and from which she retired in September 2017. She earned a PhD in molecular biology and a master's of public health and public health nutrition from the University of California at Berkeley. Previous faculty positions were at Brandeis University and the UCSF School of Medicine. From 1986 to 88, she was senior nutrition policy advisor in the Department of Health and Human Services and the editor of the 1988 Surgeon General's Report on Nutrition and Health. Her research and writing examined scientific and socioeconomic influences on food choice and its consequences, emphasizing the role of food industry marketing. She is the author, co-author, or co-editor of 15 books. I'm going to only mention a few of them. Several of them won prizes, most notably her first, which was Food Politics, How the Food Industry Influences Nutrition and Health, from 2002. Another one that I recently read was Unsavory Truth, How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat, in 2018. There's also a very cute little book, so it's easy to read. I read it too. Essays with Kerry Truman called Let's Ask Marion What You Need to Know About the Politics of Food, Nutrition, and Health in 2020. Her most recent book is a memoir, Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, 2022. From 2008 to 2013, she wrote a monthly Food Matters column for the San Francisco Chronicle Food Selection. She blogs almost daily at www.foodpolitics.com. Her Twitter account, at Marion Nessel, has been named among the top 10 in health and science by Time Magazine, Science Magazine, and The Guardian, and has more than 144,000 followers. She has received many awards and honors. I'm not going to name them all. I'm just going to give you my favorites. My favorites are... In 2011, the University of California School of Public Health at Berkeley named her a public health hero, and she really is. She's really a trailblazer, and in fact, she also got a trailblazer award from the International Association of Culinary Professionals, and my other favorite award among many, by the way, was she was selected Grand Dame of the Year by Les Dames d'Escoffier International. I hope I pronounced that correctly. Not sure when that was. So this is, for me, it was a tremendous, tremendous honor to be able to interview Dr. Nessel. And I have to say, she reached back to me right away. She was very humble and gracious, but she really is the OG, right? She is the trailblazer, the grand dame of food studies, as she says, and also, in my mind, nutrition. Although that really is more separate. It's really food science that she has established as a field to be respected, and also has done and continues to do incredible advocacy so that we can all have information so we can make better choices. Thank you so much for joining me today, Dr. Nessel. And it's Dr. Nessel for everybody. It's not Dr. Nestle.
I'm really glad to be here.
I am so excited and so honored to do this with you. And we already been talking and we could talk all day, and I'm going to try to stay focused here. I read your latest book, Slow Cooked, An Unexpected Life in Food Politics, and I absolutely loved it. I resonated with it so much. I want to talk about it. I want to let you talk about it. I just want to say, though, that in general, you know, the subtitle is An Unexpected Life in Food Politics. Not everybody is going to be a policy wonk or even a political person, but we all have to eat. It affects all of us. And I can't think of anyone better to discuss this topic. And I mean, the topic of food intertwining with nutrition and weight and politics than you. You are the grand dame.
Thanks.
I'm so excited. So I'm going to let you start talking about your book, maybe why you wrote it.
Okay, that's an easy place to start. The pandemic is the quick and dirty answer to that. I have a fairly complicated personal life. I live in Manhattan, but my partner lives upstate in Ithaca, New York. And when the pandemic started, I moved up there, which is where I am now. And I didn't have anything to do. It was, you know, lots of people didn't have anything to do during the pandemic. And I couldn't get into libraries. I write nonfiction books about food politics that require an enormous amount of research, not all of which can be done online. And I couldn't get into libraries. I couldn't get into my office. I couldn't get into anywhere where I could look up anything. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? Maybe the time has come when I should try to, in a serious way, address questions that I get asked all the time. And these questions have to do with, you know, how did you get interested in food? How did you get interested in nutrition? How did you get interested in food politics? How do you feel about being a target of food industry complaints? How do you feel about being on the front line all the time? What did you do at NYU? Where did food studies come from? I mean, all of these questions about my career, which by this time is very long one. And I thought, well, maybe this is a time to sit down and really try to deal with that in a comprehensive and pretty serious way and tell the story. And so it was my pandemic project. And the thing about memoirs is I refer to this as my first work of fiction.
I love it.
because it's not necessarily based on fact. It's based on what you remember. And so this is what I remember. And this is my version of what I think my life was about and the factors that induced me to have the kind of career that I ended up having, which took a very, very long time, hence the title Slow Cooked. And it was a good time to do that. I had the time and the space and the place to do it. And it worked out pretty well, I think.
Yeah. I'm so glad that you did it because you're an icon, and an icon could be caricaturized, right?
Oh, I never don't think of myself as an icon, but that's all right.
Oh, you are. But, you know, we haven't heard a lot about you as a person. I tried looking you up on Wikipedia, and it was really not a lot about you as a person.
Well, I try to have a private life.
Right, you are private. You're private.
I'm actually a very private person. And this is a, I'm uncomfortable about being recognized on the street. I would not like to be somebody who was so famous that you couldn't walk down the street without being accosted by people who have projected their own emotional whatever on you. I don't think I would like that. I like being able to walk down the street in New York and not be accosted. And the I'm an academic. You know, I'm not a celebrity. I'm an academic, and I have a very academic way of looking at all of these things. So it's a professional memoir. It's not a personal memoir. Also, I have an ex-husband who's still alive.
And I have
children who are still alive, and I'm on very good relations with all of them. I want to keep it that way. A professional memoir gets you out of having to deal with personal things that might hurt feelings or that kind of thing. And I didn't want to do that.
Right. But it is personal in a way that I know resonated very deeply with me.
Yeah.
Right? The idea of slow cook, the idea that you can come later in life and you can have a huge impact. I mean, don't just say you're an academician, right? I mean, you have basically created and nurtured the field of nutrition as a science, something to be taken seriously.
Well, food studies more than nutrition.
Okay,
nutrition,
fair.
Well, nutrition kind of goes on without me, but but certainly food studies, and I tell the story about how we developed food studies at NYU. It was quite a fluke, but when we started food studies in the mid 90s, we were the only university in the country that had a program called food studies. There was a gastronomy program at Boston University, but now they all have them. You know, so that's kind of exciting. It isn't, you don't always get to start a new field of study. That I'm really pleased about. And it's been very exciting to watch it, you know, to watch the competition grow. It's just been wonderful.
For sure. But still people say nutrition is not a science. It's a pseudoscience. Mm. I'm throwing it out there for you. What do you say to those people?
Well, you know, I think nutrition scientists do the best they can with a very, very difficult situation. Nutrition research is really hard to do. I think of it as the most intellectually challenging question in the field of nutrition is to find out what people actually eat. And, you know, to dismiss that as non-science is to completely miss the point of how difficult and intellectually challenging it is to try to figure out how people who eat different diets from day to day and different diets from person to person, how you can study those diets and correlate them with people's health. That's really hard to do. So this is a tough science. I look at it as something that's really, really intellectually challenging, and to dismiss it out of hand misses that point completely.
Right. And I don't think that it's being dismissed out of hand for no good reason. I'd love to talk about also Unsavory Truth, which is the other book that I just finished reading. This one was a 2018 book. Because I think there's reasons why nutrition is being mocked. I mean, we all say, oh, one day they say fat is good. One day they say fat is bad. One day they say, you know, dairy is good. One day they say dairy is bad. Why is it so confusing? Why isn't it simple?
Well, there's a forest for trees problem. If you look at the forest, as I'm fond of saying, the journalist Michael Pollan can summarize dietary principles in 7 words: eat food, not too much, mostly plants. That's really all there is to it. Everything else is trees, it's details. And the arguments are about the details. The arguments aren't about the fundamental principles. But the details are fun. And the details are what people eat from day to day. And because everybody eats, everybody's an expert on nutrition. I think that's kind of fun too. I love people's craziness about food. I just love it. I just love the way people are passionate about the way they eat, feel like no other way of eating is appropriate, and it gets you into the whole question of where science and belief and personal experience come in, which is a very, very, very important societal problem right now. And nutrition is right in the middle of it, because people believe, you know, half of the American adult population takes supplements. There is virtually no evidence that taking, if you're a reasonably healthy person and you take a supplement, you're going to be healthier. There's no evidence that shows that. And yet people continue to take them. So this is where belief hits science. And it's very, very much the same kind of thing that's going on politically right now, which is why food and nutrition are so terrific to teach, because you can explain how these things work in something that students can understand and relate to. And then they can just take that and, you know, look at the larger society. Food relates to absolutely everything. I like that about it, too.
It is fascinating, and it's all intertwined, which is what makes it so hard to study. You really can't isolate one factor. And that's, I think, a lot of the studies being done now are looking at one factor, antioxidants in pomegranate juice. Right?
Yes, right.
but that's a perfect segue to what the industries are doing. And I really want to hear more from you, from some of the things you talk about in Unsavory Truth about the industries. Because when we talk about people being passionate about food, and that's a reason why it's so confusing, I think it's more than that. I think we're intentionally being confused.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, to me, the simplest thing to say about the entire food system is to understand that food companies are not social service agencies. Even though they provide food that we love, they're not doing us a big favor, because that's their goal. They're not public health agencies. They're not social service agencies. They're businesses. And like any other business in the United States, their job is to produce profits for stockholders. And once you understand that is the single most important purpose of a food company, is profits to stockholders. It's not to make people healthy. It's not to make people sick. It's not to make people anything. It's to sell a product. The product that they're selling could be a widget of any kind. It's about widgets, not food and health. So you as a consumer are concerned about food and health. The people who are selling you food are interested in widgets and profits. Once you understand that, everything that goes on is very clear. And Unsavory Truth is a book about everything that goes on. And its subtitle is How Food Companies Skew the Science of What We Eat. It's a book about food companies' manipulation of food and nutrition research in order to sell products and to sell more products. And the particular problem about selling more food in the United States is the big, deep, dark secret of the American food system, which is there's too much food available. Right. We have available about 4,000 calories a day for every man, woman, and little tiny baby in the country. And that's roughly twice average need for the population. So that puts food companies, profit-driven, into a very difficult situation, because they have only two choices. They can get people to eat their product instead of somebody else's, or they can get people to eat more in general. And that's what they did. And they did that really, really well. I mean, if you want to look at the history of obesity in the United States, until about 1980, the prevalence of obesity was, you know, 15-20%, some relative, and among children practically non-existent. Mm-hmm. And then starting in the 1980s, the prevalence of obesity started to rise quite dramatically, in parallel with a rise in the number of calories in the food supply.
Wait, just for one second. I never heard you explain why we have so many extra calories or food.
Oh, it had to do with three things that happened in the early 1980s. First of all, 1980 is the inflection point. It's when President Reagan was elected. And it was the onset of what is referred to as neoliberal capitalism, is when all that really started then. In the 1970s, there were agricultural policies changed from putting restrictions on what farmers could grow to pushing farmers to grow as much food as they possibly could in order to take advantage of federal subsidies. And that increased, and farmers were very good at that. They increased production enormously. And then when President Reagan came in, he deregulated a lot of constraints on food marketing. And so companies were able to market more extensively. But the big thing that happened in the early 1980s was the advent of this shareholder value movement, which was a movement of people who owned stocks to get rid of blue chip stocks that gave long, slow returns on investment, and instead to provide immediate higher returns on investment. And Wall Street changed the way it evaluated companies so that companies then had to report growth to Wall Street every 90 days. Which put an enormous amount of pressure on food companies. So they had to look for ways to sell more food, basically. And they did that by putting food in places where it had never been sold before. Libraries, bookstores, clothing stores. Food is everywhere. It never used to be there. I remember when I came to NYU, there were signs all over the library saying, you bring food into the library, that's grounds for expulsion. Now there are cafes in the library, and bookstores have cafes. You couldn't, you know, I can remember when you couldn't bring a cup of coffee into a bookstore. They asked you to drink it outside. They didn't want you spilling coffee on the books. You know, now there's Starbucks in bookstores.
Right, and you can't go down the clothing store, you know, aisle without a whole queue of junk food.
Yeah, I mean, with the chocolate bars at the checkout counter or whatever. Yeah. And then they made food in larger portions. And, you know, if there's one explanation for people gaining weight, it's larger portions. If I had one nutritional concept I could get across, it would be that larger portions have more calories. Trust me, it's not intuitively obvious. So in the 1980s, I had a doctoral student who documented how portion sizes increased in the 1980s. Everybody loves a bargain. And the most expensive things about food production is labor cost and marketing costs. The cost of food is very cheap because there's too much of it around. And so, you know, there was a big push for people to eat more calories, and they did. There's plenty of evidence that calorie intake increased by enough during the period 1980 to 2000 to account for the average 10 to 20 pound weight gain in the population.
Yeah, but people are often saying that it's just the sugar. I see a lot of people talking about sugar.
Well, sugar has calories, and sugar makes you love to eat. I mean, the point about what are now called ultra-processed foods is that they're formulated to be irresistible, and they have lots of sugars, they have lots of fat, they have salt, they have things you love. And once you start eating them, you can't stop. And they're deliberately formulated to be that way. And people respond to that. And we now have, you know, very, very good evidence that what are now called ultra-processed foods, which are the really heavily processed ones, encourage people to eat more. There's really good evidence for that. So we sort of understand why people started eating more and ate more calories. And once you get used to that, it's pretty hard to go back.
You get that genie back in the bottle.
Yeah, it's pretty tough.
But you know what? I like how you say you can vote with your fork.
Yes.
I don't know if you want to elaborate on that, because I think that's such an important concept. I mean, I think that there are changes being made. I think more people are aware of soda, for example, the problems with soda.
Yeah, that was a big public health initiative, was to try to get people to, I have another book, Soda Politics, which talks about how you advocate for policies to encourage people to drink fewer sugary drinks. And I say fewer. I mean, I think sugary drinks are fine, but never in more than 8 ounces.
Right.
Certainly not 16 or 24 or liters worth the way they're sold.
And it's cheaper that way.
Yeah, there's sugars in water and nothing else. They have no nutritional value. And there's now tons of evidence that sugary drinks encourage bad metabolic outcome and get people to take in too many calories without realizing it and all of those things. So there's some unconscious things that are going on that make it very, very difficult for people to control their calorie intake. And I'm, you know, I think the evidence shows that it's calories. You want to lose weight, you got to eat fewer calories or move more. It's just that it's really hard to do that. And most people can't because it requires changing your life. Or restructuring your entire relationship with food, which is very, very difficult to do, particularly if you live in a food environment, which we all do, where the entire purpose of that food environment is to get you to eat more.
It's really, really true. And I do want you to talk a little bit more about the conflicts of interest in the studies on food.
Yeah. And I write a daily blog at foodpolitics.com. And every Monday, because I'm on a crusade, I post the industry funded study of the week or some industry funded thing that just makes your eyes roll. And the thing about industry funded studies is that they're designed for marketing purposes. They're not really about science. They're about selling food products. And the companies, and I cannot think of a single company or food product that doesn't do this. They all do it. They hire researchers to do studies basically that will demonstrate that their products are healthy, that they don't cause any harm, that anything that says they're harmful is done so badly that you don't have to pay any attention to it, and that physical activity is more important than what you eat in trying to lose weight, all of which are not shown by data. And some of these things are hilarious. I find them very entertaining because I can look at the title of a study and think, why would anybody do a study like this? There's only one reason why they were do a study like this. Who paid for this? Bingo. I can predict who paid for it by the title. And if I know who paid for a study, I know what the results are going to be, because you get what you pay for. And it's not that the researchers who do this work are doing work for money in that direct way. They are completely unconscious of the influence of that money on what they're doing. They don't realize that they are designing studies to give them the answer that the sponsor wants. And there's lots of evidence that shows this. I mean, it seems ridiculous on its face, but in fact, there's a great deal of evidence in the gift literature. Mm-hmm. There's a whole literature on the effects of gifts that shows this. And so the research will do very good science, but the research question will have been designed in a way to skew the results and give you the results that you want. And everybody does this. The meat industry, the dairy industry, every fruit and vegetable you can think of, because they're competing with each other for sales. And everybody wants to prove that every fruit or vegetable is or nut is a superfood. I mean, the whole concept of superfood is a marketing concept. And I'm all for eating fruits and vegetables. I really am.
But blueberries, they have antioxidants.
No, you have antioxidants, right? Everything has antioxidants. Every fruit and vegetable has antioxidants. You know, the secret of healthy diets is eating a wide variety of healthy foods. Vary them. Eat the ones you like. Eat different ones. And to the extent that you do that, your nutritional needs are taken care of. But everybody worries about their diet, and the marketers are so good at tapping into people's anxieties about food that, you know, you walk down the aisles of supermarkets and the ads just scream out at you. You know, I told you I'm doing this thing about infant formula. I'm writing a book chapter about infant formulas right now. And the infant formulas are full of comments. It has DHA. You know, it's got probiotics. It's
prebiotics.
Prebiotics. It's got probiotics. It's got everything you could possibly think of in it. And you think, if I don't feed my baby this, I'm going to be malnourishing my baby. When in fact, the evidence that these things are needed is really pretty minimal.
I mean, the names are like NeuroPro, make a better NeuroPro. Brain.
Right, right. Yeah. If you want your baby to be smart, you feed them NeuroPro. Exactly. You know, I just roll my eyes at that, but you fall for it because it hits. There must be some way in which humans are hardwired to respond to things like this, because we do.
There's nothing more primal than feeding your child. There's nothing more primal. There isn't.
Exactly, right.
As a pediatrician, I mean, this breaks my heart, right? Because I see so much anxiety around food. And you can't raise a healthy eater in a sea of anxiety. You just can't.
Yeah, I mean, I remember being so shocked at having lunch with a friend who had a 9-month-old, and she didn't bring any food for the kid. I said, "You didn't bring any food for the kid?" She said, "Oh, she'll just eat what I eat." And she took her lunch, cut it up into little tiny pieces, put it on the kid's tray, and the kid went after it. I thought, oh, somebody who was raising a healthy eater.
I know, right? Do you know what I deal with now? All these pouches and puffs all day long. Have you seen those pouches?
Oh, yes, pouches. Don't get me started.
Don't get me started.
They have so much sugar.
It's just, building a, ultra-processed food eater from the beginning.
Yeah, they don't say they have sugar. They have fruit juice concentrates.
Oh, don't even get me started on juice for children.
Right? Oh, yeah, that one too. Yeah, I mean, and what you want is you want your kid to be like that. When you want your kid to be eating adult flavors and textures, if the adults are eating healthfully and the pieces are cut up small enough, the kid should have fun with it and enjoy the pleasure of food. Once you get kids started on the only thing they'll eat is something that's sugary or fatty, fried or sugary, then it's very, very difficult, because they catch on right away that if they complain, poor, tired, exhausted parents and caretakers are going to say, "I don't want to fight with my kid about food." I certainly didn't want to fight with my kids about food. And I had picky eaters.
Right. No, I didn't.
This was before I knew anything about nutrition. So that's my excuse. And I was also quite young. That's my excuse. But looking back on it, it was just an awful problem. I had one kid that refused to eat vegetables and one that refused to eat meat. Now what am I supposed to do? Well, I don't know. They survived.
They survive on air. They really do. But then you get anxious, and then you've got the processed food, and then the kids see them and they want them. It's a vicious cycle. It really, really is. I want to know your thoughts on the obesity epidemic. You alluded to it earlier. You talked about eating less calories, but I want more of your thoughts on that, please, because we're really struggling now. I mean,
it's very difficult. Yeah, we're in a very difficult.
It's normal now to be obese.
Yeah, the CDC says that 74%, 3/4 of American adults are overweight or obese, or they meet the body mass index criteria for overweight or obese. That means it's normal. So if you have a situation in which being overweight is normal in the population, and you suggest that there's something wrong with that, you are offending a very, very large number of people. We know without question, and the COVID-19 pandemic showed this as clearly as I've ever seen anything shown, that being overweight is a risk factor for bad outcome for COVID, as well as for heart disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes, and overall mortality. That's been shown over and over and over again. It's a risk factor.
Right. I will add, as a doctor, though, I will add that the category that's not as clear as the overweight BMI of 25 to 30.
Okay,
it's
I'm
much more clear
that.
For the.
Yeah, I'm getting to that.
Okay.
The argument is not whether obesity is a risk factor for all of these diseases. The argument is about where the cut point is.
Right.
And that's a complicated argument. A BMI of 25, oh boy. You can argue about that one a lot. But I'm not worried about the BMI of 25, except for people for whom the BMI of 25 is too high.
Right, right. I mean, I think that's the point.
You only know by checking their metabolic.
Metabolic, right. That was the point, is that different people have different body sizes. There
Absolutely.
Is a point to the body, neutrality movement that the BMI is flawed, and that especially in the lower end of the BMI, people can be very metabolically healthy. That may be what they're meant to be. And then there are others who have a lower BMI who have higher risk, say like for type 2 diabetes for whatever reason.
Right. Yeah. So we're talking about a risk factor.
Exactly.
The concept of risk is very difficult to understand.
Right.
It's probability. You have to be able to think in probabilities and stuff. And I'm also enormously opposed to stigma.
Right.
The fact that people who are living in large bodies are stigmatized is incontrovertible.
Right.
You know, they live with it every day. I did a blurb for a really terrific book about what it was like to live in a fat body, and fat was her term. And it's like being Black. Right. In much the same way, you're subject to constant commentary, constant treatment, and constant discrimination. And it's very difficult for people who aren't in that situation to understand what it's like to have that kind of thing. I found her account of her daily experience walking through the world to be quite shocking. And very disturbing. And you think, okay, that needs to stop. And to the extent that overweight is normalized, there'll be more and more people who are upset about being categorized, and maybe it'll stop. But the real question is, it is a risk factor for disease and poor health. What can be done about it? And there, if you are fighting obesity, you're fighting an entire food system.
Right.
This is a lot to ask of any one individual. And federal policy, I mean, I'm astounded by the lack of attention to trying to do something about overweight as a risk factor at the federal level. They don't want to touch it. You know, they absolutely don't want to touch it. There's no national program to try to help people reduce their weight or to prevent weight gain. And whenever there are any kind of policies that come in, there are things that individuals do,
right?
Like food labels or calorie labels. I mean, who ever thought that that would work? You can't, as an individual, bear the entire burden of society and expect to get through that in any reasonable way. You need help.
Right.
And the society doesn't help. And the society doesn't help in lots of ways.
Right.
And we live in I like to ask the question, what changed in 1980? I think a lot of economic system things changed. Wall Street changed. But there were other things that changed as well. You know, cell phones are an enormous factor in weight gain because kids aren't outside playing. You know, I think about what I did when I was a kid and what my kids did. I would throw them out of the house and say, don't come back until dinner time. You know, that would be impossible now.
Right. And it's all interconnected to the anxiety, the rise in anxiety. It all interconnects.
Oh, absolutely.
Right? The digital media, the anxiety, the overeating.
Yeah.
It's a perfect storm.
And the fear about leaving your kids outside unsupervised, right. I mean, that kind of thing is just astounding to me. It's so different from the way I grew up and the way I raised my kids. But I'm, four generations removed. And so really look at it from what is now a ridiculously historical perspective. But I can see the changes that have taken place. And I don't see how those things are reversible, except to build cities in ways that that make it easier for people to walk and ride bicycles than to be in cars. So there's a reason why people who live in New York City don't have the same prevalence of obesity as people who live in rural areas or in cities that don't have public transportation systems. You want to help people reduce weight, you build the public transportation system. You know, using the New York City subways requires the ability to walk distances and walk up and down stairs. Because the escalators never work. So you have to be able to walk up and down stairs. The distances between subway stops require walking. All of those things are very healthy. I've lived in New York for years without a car. The easiest way to maintain a healthy body weight is not to have an automobile. You know, I mean, that's a different way of living for a lot of people.
Right. I want to keep it practical for everybody, though. I don't want people to throw up their hands and say, well, okay, I live in the suburbs. I have an automobile. I'm busy. Mm-hmm. I have to buy processed food or whatever. Mm-hmm. Let's really break it down and take some points for people to take from this of what they can do, because I don't want people to feel disempowered. I want them to feel empowered. Because I think we can all make a difference. You did. We can.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's really simple. Mm-hmm. Eat less, not too much, mostly plants. So that means, or eat food, not too much, mostly plants. By food, it means foods that are relatively unprocessed, the kinds of foods that you have to cook or that are prepared for you, but they're real foods. They're not heavily processed foods. And when I wrote my book, Soda Politics, I did not write it as a diet manual. I wrote it as an advocacy manual. This is how you develop campaigns to get sodas out of schools, to get sodas out of cities, to tax sodas, whatever. And after I wrote the book, I started getting letters from people and emails from people saying, I read your book, I lost 10 pounds. I read your book, I lost 20 pounds. Because most people eat by the clock or eat by the time of day and don't even know what hunger feels like because they're overeating so much. And so getting back into some kind of balance on that is difficult but worth trying. And even small changes in the amount you eat add up. But eat food, not too much, mostly plants. Really, that covers it. And that leaves, for me, it leaves enormous amounts of room for the most important thing, which is the pleasure of food.
Right, right. I want to say a couple things before I forget, is that I very strongly recommend working with a registered dietitian, if at all possible. Not everybody has coverage for that or the money to spend on that. But what I say as a pediatrician is, I say, you know how they say it's not rocket science? Nutrition is rocket science. And they send it to one because everybody's different. And I'm very much against the yo-yo dieting that causes people to put on more weight in the long run. The problem with a diet that's not sustainable for the long run is that people often lose weight in the short term and put on even more weight and have even more metabolic side effects from that. So I'm going to say very strongly as a doctor, I do not recommend yo-yo dieting. Dieting in of itself has come under a lot of fire for causing that.
No, I mean, you need a lifestyle change where you just eat differently. And I'm greatly in favor of eating foods. And as I said, I'm a great believer in calories. So you have to find a way that works, that doesn't make you miserable and that allows you to enjoy what you're eating. I think that's really important. I happen to be really lucky. I like salads.
You're so lucky.
I like that.
Not
everybody does. And I completely understand that. So I don't expect everybody to be like me, and I don't advise anybody to do anything that I couldn't do ever.
Right. Everybody's different. And there's a lot of other factors, by the way, your genetics, other health conditions, your stress in your life, your access, your finances. There's so many different factors. But I love you have a very generous approach here. Right. I have found it as a parent to be so anxiety provoking because the news kept changing. Right. Mm-hmm. And all you want to do is bring up healthy kids.
Stop
and then they're picky.
Listening to it.
Turn it off.
Turn it off.
Best advice ever.
How did we raise children without all of this? Somehow we managed.
It's really, really true. So I don't know if you want to add anything. I mean, we could really be talking all day. We kind of veered away from the big food and we didn't really go down that rabbit hole, but people can definitely read Unsavory Truth. I'm feeling like maybe you don't want to go down too deep into that hole today.
No, it's fine. Whatever you want to talk about, it's fine with me.
I mean, I was really taken by the book because it's so sneaky what they're doing.
It's just marketing. That's all.
But it works.
Of course it works.
How do you avoid being so influenced by the marketing?
You have to recognize it as marketing. I mean, that's part of why I write that Monday blog at foodpolitics.com.
Right.
Every Monday. And I know that it's working, at least with the people who read my blog, because they send me things. They start running across these things. and they send them to me. That's how I get most of them, is they get sent to me by readers, because even though I read a lot, I don't read everything. And they'll run across some absolutely delicious example that they think is hilarious. And, you know, I think, oh, thank you for sending that. And up it goes. But they're, you know, it's not as if food company executives are sitting around a table saying, how can we make Americans fat? That's not what they're doing. They're sitting around a table saying, how on earth are we going to make a profit in a food environment in which there's too much food available?
But it's the same thing. But it's the same thing in the end. For us, it's the same thing.
For the consumer, it's exactly the same thing.
Right.
It's exactly the same thing, because you're being marketed to. And, you know, in my book, Soda Politics, I have a chapter on how to teach kids to be critical thinkers in supermarkets, you know, how you walk down an aisle and know immediately that you're being marketed to. And it's pretty easy to do that once you pay attention to it. The problem is that when people are in supermarkets, they don't want to pay attention to it. All you want to do in a supermarket is to get in and out of there, spending as little money as possible. And the, you know, I mean, I find them enormously entertaining, and I spend hours and hours and hours reading food labels and looking at the front of packages and thinking, oh, they have to be kidding. But you fall for it, you know, and the government agencies are not much help.
No.
But there's some help. You know, I'm very fond of cereal boxes because they change all the time, and that's where the marketing really shows up first. And I have a huge collection of cereal boxes, and it's kind of disappointing now because the really fun ones that used to have me on the ceiling, you know, that kind of thing, they can't do that anymore. And so that's kind of too bad. You know, the ones on sugary kids cereals that had a big immunity banner across the front, they can do that on infant formula, but they cannot do it on foods.
Okay, how come?
FDA regulations.
Okay, so we're getting somewhere, maybe?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. You know, I mean, there's so much industry pushback whenever any federal agencies tries to put some restrictions on these marketing things. And remember, you know, I mean, the big issue about marketing is really about marketing to children. You know, you could think, okay, adults, you've got free will, you're smart enough to be able to figure out what to do. But kids need protection. And when the Federal Trade Commission tried to put restrictions on marketing to children, and this was in the 1990s, the head of the Federal Trade Commission was fired, and Congress passed a law saying that the Federal Trade Commission could not do anything about marketing to children. So that, and that was before obesity really became a problem. That was about 1980, just when it was starting. So any attempt to try to not have, and marketing to children is enormously effective, because the kids come home and they say, we want this. And what parent is going to deny? Really difficult to deny your kids something like that. And a terrific book has just come out talking about how in poor families, where there's so little that they feel that they can do for their kids,
how the other half eats.
Exactly.
That was fantastic.
A fantastic book about that.
Yeah.
And so you really understand what that situation is like. And I went in when the Obamas were in the White House. Michelle Obama had a meeting on marketing to children, which I was invited to, and I went to. She gave an eloquent speech about how food companies shouldn't be doing that. And afterwards, they broke us up into groups. And I was meeting with a group of food industry executives who said, we don't want to market to children. We think it's wrong, but our stockholders won't let us stop. Just like that.
They're not a social service agency.
Just flat out. And once you can get it through your head, that food companies are not social service agencies, everything that they do makes sense.
Clicks, yeah. But you can't keep throwing it back on the parents. I mean, as a pediatrician, this is crushing for me.
So what you can do is teach parents about what they're up against. You're up against an entire society that is trying to get you to feed your kid badly. That's what you're up
against. And to overfeed your children.
Well, that's what I meant by feeding them, to overfeed your kid. That's what, to respond to your kid's wants. I mean, I was once given by a nutritionist at Berkeley, was doing a survey of adolescents' food habits. And she said, you're not going to believe these. She had them keep daily diaries of what they ate. And what was astonishing about them was that there was nothing in their diaries that looked like a meal. It was snacking from morning to night, and mostly snacking on products, you know, junk food products or ultra-processed junk food products. And you think, well, and these were poor kids. Their families didn't have organized meals. This is the way lots of Americans eat.
Now, they're the canaries in the coal mine, though.
And the kids are the canaries.
Yeah, right. That's what I mean. Right. Can we talk a little bit about, I'm taking your time very seriously, but can we talk a little bit about food pyramids and all that went into that? I think it's called My Plate now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is the Department of Agriculture's food guide. And from 1992 to 2010, we had the food guide pyramid, which showed fruits and vegetables at the top and meat and dairy products at the top.
You need the least grain, of them, right?
And grains and food and grains and fruits and vegetables at the bottom with various portion sizes and numbers of portions on them. And visually, this showed that you were supposed to eat more fruits and vegetables and grains than you were of meat and dairy products and junk foods, which were at the top. But that was very controversial when it came out because the meat industry objected so strenuously for being at the top of the pyramid. And in 2010, under the Obama administration, it was changed to My Plate. I can't say they didn't ask me. They did. I was at a meeting where this was discussed, and I strongly objected to the My Plate. I thought the pyramid was much better. And the other nutrition professors who were at that meeting, we proposed that they simply reverse the fruit and vegetable and grain line so that fruits and vegetables were at the bottom. You were supposed to eat the most of those.
Mm-hmm. Eat plants.
eat plants. Right. But we were overturned. And so it's a plate that nobody uses and nobody pays any attention to and nobody knows exists. And the Department of Agriculture has not come out with a new one. Usually there's a new food guide with each new set of dietary guidelines, which come out every 5 years, but there hasn't been a new food guide since 2010.
It's hard to take it seriously once you know how much lobbying there is.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Right? Yeah,
it's enormously politically fraught, and the process has gotten, if anything, the process has gotten more politicized, because I was on the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee in 1995, and we did the research. Let me start from the beginning. We established the research questions. We did the research. We wrote the dietary guidelines and turned them in. And the federal agencies may have done a little bit of editing and they packaged it into whatever the format was. But basically, the committee was responsible for the whole thing. That changed during the Bush 2 administration, when the agencies took over. And now the agencies determine the questions. The advisory committee does the research and writes a research report, and the agencies do the guideline. So whatever political party is in power and whoever the agency heads are, determine what the guidelines are going to say. And this is another situation in which they seem to change all the time, but they don't really. They've all, since 1980, the dietary guidelines have said eat more fruits and vegetables, don't eat too much saturated fat, salt, or sugar. That's a euphemism for highly processed
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it says eat less, you don't right. balance your calories. So, I mean, those have never changed. They're just the details change.
Right. And to try to push you away from taking away from any of the industries.
Right. So, right. you know, you're not supposed to eat less of any American agricultural product or food product because that's un-American. So I don't know. It's the new dietary guidelines advisory committee is about to be appointed. I've heard that it'll come out any day now because I've already heard from one person who's on it. So they've obviously told people who are on it that they're on it. So we're going to get to go through this again. I find it very entertaining. I've had a whole career on dietary guidelines, but analyzing dietary guidelines. So it's nice that they're still coming out.
I'm glad you find it funny. I'm frustrated.
I do find
I'm so frustrated funny. As a pediatrician because it doesn't have to be this hard. Mm-hmm. I like all the things you do, all the things you've written. You make so many things so clear to people. Just eat less, right? Eat more plants. Like, you know, you're just doing Michael Pollan, but more explaining.
I don't find it very complicated. And enjoy your food. I want that one in there.
Because that's really important.
Of life's greatest pleasures. People love to eat. I mean, we're hardwired to love to eat. That's how we stay alive. So to turn that into a source of anxiety, or when people right. tell me that they think food is their enemy, it just makes me weep because it's so sad. And I don't find it difficult, but, you know, the world divides into lumpers and splitters.
Right.
I'm a lumper, freely admitted, and I don't really care about the details that much. And yet the devil is in the details.
As
they say, always. So, you know, I want people to love their food. I want them to enjoy food. I want them to feed their kids healthfully. I think it's quite possible to do that, but it requires a fair amount of knowledge and a fair amount of thinking that it's important. It's why school food is so important.
Right.
And there certainly are people who do school food really, really well. Schools that do school food really well and others that don't. And if you're lucky enough to be in one that does it well, you're really lucky.
Right. And you can still raise healthy eaters on your own. Nobody should feel disempowered. It starts from the very beginning. I did a talk, by the way, with the nutritionist I mentioned to you before we started talking, Yaffe Lavov. It was called Hunger Games. And I think that's where it's at, is working on your own issues with food, trying to have the healthier food in the home, right, to begin with, and raising children to love to eat healthy food. It's not an oxymoron.
Yeah, and if you eat healthy food, your kids will eat healthy food. You know, they may sneak off and have junk food once in a while, but that's really okay.
Right, and you don't have to make a big deal of it.
Yeah, it's okay. And but you have to model in the house what you want your kids to be eating. If you're eating a lot of junk food, then you can't stop them from eating it.
You can't say do as I say, not as I do.
Exactly. And if you don't want them eating it, you don't have it in the house. You know, I mean, I used to take my kids to McDonald's on their birthdays. That's once a year.
Right.
And I was actually, those were fabulous birthday parties. They make it really easy for you. And you can go to McDonald's more than once a year. It's really all right. But every day, no.
Right. But making it a never food, right, just makes it that much more alluring to kids. And that doesn't work.
So. Yeah. And it doesn't work, and there's no point in it because right. I don't know. I mean, I just had a long discussion with some reporter about mac and cheese. You know, one of those boxes of mac and cheese is 200 calories. It's very hard to get upset about. You know, it's not the ideal food, but it's food. It's got some nutrients in it. And it's only 200 calories.
Right. You're not going to ruin your life with, you know, right, some exactly. Even ultra processed food, a little bit of it. It's the right. problem is the volume.
I eat ultra processed foods. I just try not to eat too much of them.
Right. It sounds so basic, but we're really up against a lot. But I want to thank you so much. We could talk all day and we'll never be done. And we have to talk more about baby formula.
Right. Let's do it again.
Yes. Thank you so, so much. This has been an amazing, amazing opportunity for me and for my listeners. So I really want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.
My pleasure. It's been fun to talk to you, and I hope we'll get to do it again.
Yes, I totally want to. I'm ready.
Okay, good.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to the JOMA Preventative Health Podcast. If you've enjoyed this, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and share this with your friends. For more information, check out our Instagram at JOMA_org. Check out our website, www.joma.org, that's JOWMA.org, or email us at health@joma.org.